And Racine, 20. For Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, wind chill is 16. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. On the eve of the 50th Super Bowl, we're going to replay our interview with a gentleman from Sports Illustrated who contributed and helped edit a magnificent book on the history of the Super Bowl. And we'll have a football-related interview from the archives as well for your enjoyment. Well, if there is a football fan for whom you need to purchase a gift this holiday season, I heartily recommend a magnificent new book that is just out from Sports Illustrated called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. It looks back over the near half century of Super Bowls that have been played over the decades, and it helps chart the history of the game. And one of the things that we come away from as we see this book is how drastically the game has changed. That is, the Super Bowl itself, how drastically it has changed from that first Super Bowl waged back in 1967 when the Packers defeated the Chiefs in resounding fashion. There is very little about that game that could perhaps possibly have foretold just the incredible extravaganza which it would eventually become. Austin Murphy has done very, very good work in the beautifully written introduction which adorns this book, and he's here to tell us more about it. Once again, it's titled Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game, and it comes to us from Sports Illustrated, where he is a senior writer. Austin Murphy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. That was well done, and we appreciate the kind words. I'm right with you. It's astonishing to look back. Time has really flown. One of my favorite pictures, for purposes of comparing, you know, where we are and where we've been, was on the right-hand page. This is early on. There is a snapshot of, I think it was just a media day, which has turned into this frenzy with, you know, several thousand correspondents, and in some ways, it's sort of it's an apt metaphor. Or a reflection of what the game has become. It is excess embodied. And on the page next to it, there's Joe Namath in, I guess, what would be the 60s equivalent of board shorts. And he's, he's talking to a few journalists. I think it's on the beach in outside the Fountain Blue Hotel. And it was right around the time he was guaranteeing victory. The Jets' victory over the Colts, which in fact he pulled off. He had just a kind of an ordinary game, but the Jets did beat the Colts, and it lent the game a lot of legitimacy. But they were certainly simpler times.
Absolutely. There is one lone television man with a microphone in Mr. Namath's face and a rather antiquated-looking TV camera we see in the foreground of the picture, and a scattering of a few people in the background. And you're right, the opposite page of that spread shows a modern-day media day for the Super Bowl, and it is a mass of humanity. And right there, in a nutshell, is one very clear sense of how this game has become what somebody, I think it was you, said is now an international cultural extravaganza. As you look over this history, how much of your feelings about that are regret? That is, do you spend a lot of time regretting that what was in the beginning a fairly simple game between two great football teams has become this other thing? I mean, do you regret that at all? Not that you're responsible for it, but...
No, I think there was a time, perhaps when I was younger, when there would be resentment at, for instance, being sent into media day with instructions to, you know, find a fresh angle or try to get somebody by themselves, and it's just impossible. And I think now I'm just more... You walk into it and let the experience wash over you and kind of appreciate and not feel one way or the other about it. It's just, it is what it is, and it's where we are. It's interesting. I was the college football writer at Sports Illustrated for a decade or more in the aughts. I've had a couple of turns doing college football and wrote a book called Saturday Rules, really making the case for why the college game is more fun than, you know, the corporate colossus NFL, the no fun league. It's huge, anodyne, impersonal. And yet our focus groups repeatedly have told us that, you know, people cannot get enough of the NFL. And so here I am. And I'm not agreeing or disagreeing. I'm just I'm finding the stories in each locker room and making human connections, and you know, grateful to have a job in print media in the year 2015.
Right. In your introduction called The Fantastic Voyage, which I think is beautifully written and really, really fascinating, you quote somebody as calling the Super Bowl America's last great campfire. I think it was a marketing officer from the NFL. You must think that's an interesting quote if you include it in your introduction. What do you think Mr. Waller is getting to when he characterizes the Super Bowl in this way, as America's last great campfire?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for the kind words. I remember making the point right around that place in the essay. I used that quote just to make the point that this game in particular, this event, has long since sort of transcended sport, achieved escape velocity. It is now, it's a global event. So we marvel at it for that reason alone, and how far it's come from that, you know, that first Super Bowl, which was really just a glorified exhibition game between, you know, the two champions of different leagues. What happens in every Super Bowl, the sort of things that we remember and talk about become a national currency. You know, the Monday, and for years and decades afterward, they're commemorated in books like this one and on NFL films. We're not just talking about what happened during the game, and hopefully we got a good game. Half the time you get a pretty good game, and 25% of the time I think you get a dog game or a rout, and the other times, like last year, you get a really good game, and you know, that actually lives up to the hype. But it doesn't have to live up to the hype, because it is also a discussion about the Super Bowl halftime show. I have another essay in the book talking about the evolution of the halftime show, which was a lot of fun. But, you know, the film festival, that is the discussion over, you know, who had the best commercial, you know, and who did what kind of a job on the national anthem. So there's a lot going on aside from, you know, what happened on third and long.
I am intrigued by some of the photographs that capture that very first Super Bowl, which I think you remind us was not even called a Super Bowl at the time. That name got attached a little bit later. But among the most striking things is to see just the smattering of fans that are in the stands. I mean, it appears like there weren't all that many people in attendance to see the Packers beat the Chiefs. And of course, that's in very stark contrast to what we see now, where it's probably one of the hardest tickets in all the world to get.
It is. And I know that I think the opening double truck photograph is from the first Super Bowl, and it, the captains are meeting midfield, and it's deliberately, there's this ocean of turf around them. There's only one zebra out there. You know, now there would be television cameras, and it would be a production unto itself, and it's quite deliberate, just to show you, it reflects how small bore it was compared to where we are now. The point is well taken.
Right. I appreciate another point made in your introduction in which you try to explain why there is this ferocious intensity when it comes to our fascination to the Super Bowl, our interest in it. Even people who otherwise are not particularly interested in professional football, but who find themselves drawn to this game. Not every single person, but of course a whole lot of people just cannot stay away. One of the points you make in your introduction is by contrasting the way the NFL figures out its ultimate championship with, for instance, Major League Baseball or the National Basketball Association. It's a relatively obvious point, and yet one that I don't think is all that often made or as clearly as you make it. What is it about the Super Bowl that stands apart from these other professional sports leagues?
Yeah, you know, I agree with you, and it seems self-evident. Anyway, what you're getting at is that these other championships, these are best of seven series, and the beauty of football is that it's one game, it's a one-off. How are you going to do on this particular day? So we will decide a champion not over the next 2 weeks, but over the next 3.5 hours, like 4 hours with the added commercials and halftime. And so it's the drama is distilled. To be completely honest, another thing that makes the game more picante for a lot of viewers is the fact that they have money on the game, or they bought a square, the NFL doesn't, prefers not to talk about it, but, a lot of people have action on the Super Bowl that jacks up its appeal as well.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Austin Murphy, who's responsible for the introduction to a really magnificent new book from Sports Illustrated called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. I think the way this book is put together is really quite ingenious. And I think it's terrific the way we sort of can attack this game from a lot of different angles. Can you just tell us who had a hand in the construction of the overall book and in making the decisions about the different elements that are represented here?
Yeah, these are colleagues of mine, former SI editors. What's going on is that in print media, we're really, over the last decade or so, we've been really challenged to find different ways. It's a more challenging environment, so now we're doing more books. We're looking inward and seeing that we actually have some fantastic resources, in the Sports Illustrated library. It's humbling for a writer to admit, but this book is carried by amazing photography. And I'm always, I'll see the photographers before the game. I like to take a lap during warm-up, say an hour before, even if it's cold, and maybe overhear something. Rarely you'll get something in the notebook that you can use for your game story, but I'm always running into our photographers down there, and I've seen these people for decades, and it's often, we will exchange good-natured abuse because they believe that my job is easier because I can actually miss something and then catch up on it, debrief the players and coaches afterwards. But if they miss the game-winning touchdown, it's a big problem. So anyway, they they've always done magnificent work. It's called Sports Illustrated for a reason. But yeah, to your point, they decided to break the book into quarters. So each sort of epoch of the league is, you know, we get Super Bowls 1 through X11 in the first quarter, 8 through XX1V in the next quarter. And as you can see, another of the things that I don't care for about the NFL is these Roman numerals. please, can we do away with the Roman numerals? I think, you know, they were sort of putting on airs early on. It's like they wanted to invest it with a dignity or something. But it's
grandiosity that in the early going it maybe didn't have, or people didn't see the grandiosity. And
yeah, now we're fine. Now you're fine, and you can get rid of it. It's like adding, spelling your shop with a OPPE. you're trying a little too hard. We don't need the Roman numerals.
Right.
So maybe I could just learn them and stop complaining about
them. It's probably one of the only facets of modern American life where we still use Roman numerals. Also in the book, we have space devoted to each and every Super Bowl and an excerpt from the Sports Illustrated article written at the time, another little interesting column called Just the Facts, which includes important statistics from the game, and always a photograph of that particular Super Bowl ring, what the Sports Illustrated cover looked like. And another thing I really appreciate, and I suspect you do too, is with each and every chapter, there is something called The Way It Was, in which we hear from two different players and I suppose occasionally a coach, who were directly involved in the game. One from the winning team, one from the losing team. And I so appreciate this facet because somehow it brings the game alive on a whole different level by allowing us to hear from two of the gladiators who were directly involved.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, and that was a lot of work for people to go, you know, to work the phones and find somebody from each game and debrief them and get an extra vignette or snapshot. I was just, you know, from last year's game, we have the hero, the cornerback, the Patriots cornerback Malcolm Butler, talking about how earlier in the week running against the scout team offense down on the goal line, they had run the same look slant pattern that the Seahawks called with, infamously now, notoriously. And Malcolm Butler was beat on the play. And he talks about how Coach Belichick walked up to him and said, you got to get that. And so when it was real, you know, I watched Malcolm Butler, and I remember how aggressively he played that pass and how he just took the ball away. And it's just a nice few brush strokes that I hadn't gotten anywhere else. And so thanks for bringing that up.
Do you have time for just a couple more questions?
Please.
I want to mention the fact that at the end of the book, there is a ranking of all of the Super Bowls from best to worst. And this is a really interesting list. And, of course, it's sure to generate all kinds of disagreement, consternation amongst people who have their own Super Bowl favorite that is not ranked as highly as they believe it should be. Do you know anything about how this ranking list came about? Were you part of it, a part of the calculations? And what do you think about the list as it appears here?
I was delighted to not be included in this process. it is a formula. It's not completely subjective. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 categories. So you get points for lead changes, fourth quarter drama, whether or not the team was an underdog, historical significance, and memorable player plays. And so the you know, number one was the Giants 17-14 win over New England in Super Bowl XL11, which, of course, is, you're going to let me know as soon as possible, but it was a helmet catch by David Tyree. And if you remember, Eli Manning dropped back, and he was sacked. It looked like he was sacked three different times, and Eli incredibly showing escapability and finding David Tyree, who has since faded from the landscape. I guess my only quibble would be that even in a rout sometimes, and so the routes have all settled to the bottom, 40 through 49. But even in a lopsided game, for instance, the 85 Chicago Bears, so this would have been in the 86 Super Bowl, dismembered Tony Eason and the New England Patriots. But it was historic. This was the best defense of Buddy Ryan's defense for Coach Ditka. It was the best defense you've ever seen in the NFL. And so it was something, you know, you were witnessing something you would never see again. And so it didn't deserve to be. Sometimes there's a sort of rubbernecking appeal to these routes. And there have been a number of games that were over by halftime, and which is one of the reasons that Commissioner Ozell came around to it and realized they needed a very entertaining halftime show in case, you know, the Cowboys were slaughtering the Buffalo Bills or whatever. Yeah, I like the rankings. Mostly, a book like this is basically fodder for argument, trivia, you know, it's sort of the barstool conversations. You got to have lists.
Absolutely. And I appreciate your point about, and I think maybe even in your introduction, you mentioned the fact that sometimes a lopsided game like Seattle beating Denver 43-8 can be really intriguing. In this case, to see the Seattle defense humbling the great Peyton Manning. I mean, there was something really, really fascinating about that, even if the game was never close or in any doubt. I mean, it isn't always just about how close a game is fought. Sometimes there is something really fascinating in a clinical destruction of an opponent by someone who's vastly superior. Certainly in the game of tennis, sometimes a slaughter can be a really interesting thing sometimes.
There's something Shakespearean about it, and there's such a build-up. This is the only game of the season for which there's a two-week build-up, which is a week too many, as far as I'm concerned. And so the hype machine goes into overdrive, and the pains to, the celebrations of, you know, the genius of Peyton Manning has an extra week to be amplified, and then to see him brought low, there's something perversely satisfying about that. And it wasn't just Manning, although he looked certainly didn't look like himself. I think it was the first play from scrimmage. There was a bad snap. Anyway, it was this. Fascinating entropy that takes place and seems to take place more often in the Super Bowl.
Absolutely. And we want to remind people that if they look at the book, you can certainly, as a Packers fan, of course, we have lots of Green Bay Packers fans listening, you can explore each and every one of the Packers' appearances in the Super Bowl. I think five in all but one ending in victories. And for Chicago Bears fans, you can see the Bears. And I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan as well. And it's, of course, really fun to read about the incredible successes which the Steelers have had in this big game. Let's finish up with your second essay, which is called Don't Touch That Dial. You briefly mentioned it earlier, in which you chart the dramatic transformation of the halftime show for the Super Bowl. I mean, in some respects, this is a perfect mirror of how the stature of the game has changed over the years. But it's also very much an indication of the excess That is also a mark of this extravaganza. On a really personal level, what do you think of this transformation of the halftime show for the Super Bowl?
Well, it was fun to do a deep dive on it, just because when I was younger and more cynical, I would think, and this is around the time we were getting we were having Up With People foisted on us. This is the kind of chipper group of young performers whose talent level ranged, between high school variety show and Waiting for Guffman. It was just this incomprehensible, it was busy, there was no theme, they meant well, it was too much, and it made too little sense. But what ended up happening was that there was the Super Bowl. I think Dorothy Hamill was skating around during halftime. I'm not sure how they got ice on the field.
Oh, I remember that. It was a small little circular area, and not enough to do much of anything, mostly a couple little spins. But, yeah, that was a bad miscalculation.
Well, that was the winter that Fox had counter-programmed and said, hey, listen, we all know how lame the halftime show is, so come on over to Fox for halftime. And in living color, they had a special show, and it was screamingly funny. It was raunchy, but the Wayans brothers, and the NFL got clobbered, and that was a turning point for them. They said, okay, we need to kind of rise above the dinner theater caliber entertainment, and I think they went out and got Diana Ross, and they started to take it more seriously. And the halftime show thereafter has been built around one, mega performer, and so it's become the most watched concert of the year. And then there was, of course, the Janet Jackson reveal, the inadvertent or advertent reveal, depending on who you want to believe. After which, the NFL sort of went cautious conservative. They went with a series of aging male rockers, a period of time I refer to as ARP With People, and which is kind of inside humor. And they've sort of gotten the drill down. The Madonna halftime performance was, the ratings actually bumped up during that halftime. And but they're all really chasing Michael Jackson. I thought it bogged down at the end. There was sort of a We Are the World treacle. But in the beginning, Michael Jackson was on fire, and he put on a fantastic show out in Los Angeles.
It's a really intriguing. I find myself, as I watch the halftime show, often wondering how many football fans watching the game are enjoying this. And, you know, most of the time, I'm not. I know I'm not, but it's not my kind of music. But of course, they're aiming for a wide swath of young America, I suppose, in the choices that they make. I just sometimes wish that, in a sense, they were aiming for something that would have even broader appeal. That, you know, my father-in-law would enjoy watching. Or right. I mean, right. There's a whole lot of Americans watching this Super Bowl, and I somehow feel like this halftime extravaganza is not designed with all of us in mind, in a sense. And maybe it can't be. Maybe that's impossible.
I remember watching the Black Eyed Peas a few years ago and just thinking of my octogenarian father in Rhode Island and wondering and just thinking what he must have been thinking, which is like, when, at what point did I lose the thread here? You know, just the outfits, let alone the music. But you know, I talked to an NFL executive VP about this, and they are the multi-generational family that goes to Vegas and is trying to find a show. Do you go to a magic show? Do you go to a Cirque du Soleil? No, that's too racy. So it's you can't get it right. I think I put it something along the lines of they are trying to find entertainment that would stretch like one of Keith Richards' neck waddles across multiple demographics, and it's an impossible errand. So maybe they've stopped trying, but they were, because you're doomed to fail. And I think a lot of people aren't enjoying it, but don't forget people like me who, even if it's bad, enjoy making fun of it.
You know,
there are people at the Super Bowl party who are gathered around, you know, mocking it, and there's something to be said for that, too.
Right. Tell our listeners who Lucille Walker is. She's somebody mentioned in your very interesting essay on halftime entertainment.
Yeah, well, Lucille Walker, God bless her, is the widow of Tommy Walker, also known as Tommy the Toe, who was a child actor. Actually, his dad was a musician. He was a young musician. He's playing, he's leading the band in an old movie called Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. But he was a World War II veteran who came back, and he was a hero. He matriculated at USC and was both a kicker and played in the marching band. He was the guy with the baton who led it, actually. So for extra points and field goals, he would come down from the stands, take off his Shaco hat, you know, the big hat, and kick. And he actually got a tryout offer with the Redskins, but instead took a job with Walt Disney. He was a showman, and he was the guy who first went to Pete Rozelle and said, How about if we do something special for the Super Bowl halftime? Let's have an extravaganza. And Rozelle famously said, why would we want to spend that kind of money? It's when everyone gets up to go to the bathroom. And so he won. In the early Super Bowls, I have to say, Tommy Walker had a great sense of music. You know, he was the guy who brought in the fantastic marching bands from the all-black colleges in the Southwest Athletic Conference. I'm talking about Grambling and Texas Southern. And they, you know, he just had a great sense of showmanship that they lost their way a little bit for a while, I think. Now maybe. And so Lucille Walker, I went to visit her in Southern California, and she made the same lament. And maybe they're finding their way now.
she tells you about the Super Bowl number 4, in which Tommy's halftime show employed 20,000 balloons, 50 American flags, 3,000 pigeons, 37 muskets, and 3 cannons, all for an on-field reenactment of the Battle of New Orleans. And you quote her later in the essay as saying that what America has always been hungry for is pageantry. And I guess that's as much as anything what the modern-day Super Bowl is about.
I think Tommy's shows were the word I was searching for earlier was coherence. The Super Bowl, you know, Elvis. One year they had a big magic trick, and you had to put on 3D glasses, and it was sponsored by Pepsi. Yeah, and it was Elvis Presto, a solid gold dancer who I think had been a little down on his luck, but got this gig, and it was incoherent. She was longing for the days. It's always easy to look backwards. But she felt that Tommy had gotten his due, and it made her sad. And, we spent a nice afternoon together just looking through some old scrapbooks.
Hmm. Well, that essay is a really, lovely piece. I think it has also appeared in the pages of the magazine itself. I remember reading at least something like it in Sports Illustrated. It was fun to return to it and learn so much about this aspect. And, of course, we want to remind people that the book, by and large, focuses mostly on the game of football and the way that it is played. And, of course, we hear not only about the luminaries who have made such a huge impact on the game, but also hear great stories about obscure players who have also figured one way or another. I think you tell us the story of a Green Bay Packer by the name of Max McGee, who scored the first touchdown in the first Super Bowl and had a little too much to drink the night before. Was that a story in your essay?
You know, I have at various times returned to the cautionary tale of Max McGee. I'm sure all Packers fans are familiar. For whatever reason, it's his account was one that that my people, the Murphys, I don't know, just sort of related to. But it's always be ready if you're a backup. But same, Don Beebe. I remember tracking down Don Beebe, the Buffalo Bill, who gave the Bills their only highlight in a rout. The Cowboys were just taking it to them, and Leon Lett had recovered a fumble, or perhaps he was rumbling 50-some yards with an interception return, but he held the ball out early, celebrating, and Don Beebe stripped him, and the Cowboys were not able to run up the score. And so I got Don Beebe and Leon Lett together to just talk about what the play had meant. And that was one of the reasons that Super Bowl wasn't sort of at the very bottom, because it had a memorable play.
Well, of course, we can look back over the rich history of the Super Bowl and all of the memorable plays that have been part of this great game in this really terrific book. Again, it's called Super Bowl Gold, 50 Years of the Big Game. It comes to us from the good folks of Sports Illustrated with a really interesting introduction by Austin Murphy. Austin Murphy, thank you for being so generous with your time, and congrats to you and your colleagues at Sports Illustrated for putting together this terrific book worthy of the assignment.
Thank you.
Enjoy. To finish out this pre-Super Bowl morning show here on WGTD, we turn back the clock to an interview I recorded back in 2012, which marked the 40th anniversary of one of the most extraordinary achievements in NFL history, the perfect season of the Miami Dolphins, achieved under great adversity. My guest for this interview was Mike Freeman, a highly regarded best-selling sports writer whose book about the 72 Dolphins was called Undefeated: Inside the Perfect Season of the 72 Miami Dolphins. It's a story that you can only begin to understand and appreciate if you understand just how poor a team they were before this season and the extraordinary turnaround which occurred under head coach Don Shula. Before he arrived, the Miami Dolphins were nothing less than a laughingstock.
Oh, they're really one of the, before Shula arrived, they were one of the laughingstocks in the history of professional sports. I mean, it was a disaster. The owner, Joe Robbie, was can we say frugal? And didn't spend a lot of money on facilities. Their practice field was composed of grinded up seashells that they brought in from the beach areas. Their food was, they got a deal on Chinese food. So sometimes their lunch, a lot of times their lunch was Chinese food. Think about that, eating a bunch of Chinese food before you go out into the hot Florida sun to work out. It was, they won just a handful of games. No one wanted to go to Miami. Players that were traded there were just horrified. It was considered the dead-end destination of the NFL. It was just one of the worst places you could go play football.
Right. And, of course, the single man who turns it around is the much-admired Don Shula, who had been, before that, the coach of the Baltimore Colts. Tell us about the end of his tenure there and his journey to the Dolphins.
Well, Shula was a really, really well-respected, very young coach. Coached the Colts, led them to the Super Bowl, and they lost to, in one of the most famous games in history, as you know, to Joe Namath's Jets. And it was considered a massive upset. Shula, to this day, considers it his worst loss of his career, the lowest moment of his career. So he was regarded, the irony of this is here's Shula, a guy that's coach of the perfect team, a Hall of Famer, maybe the best coach in NFL history. At one point was considered a guy who couldn't win a big game. So he goes from the Colts to this, this very prestigious, great franchise, and he goes from there to the Dolphins, which are a laughing stock. But he really felt like he needed a new start, and he, like he's so many things with his career, it was a smart move, and not just in hindsight, but it was a smart move because he could sort of create his own destiny, a new path.
And, of course, he was able to shape a really fine team out of a largely unpromising roster, or at least at a glance. It seemed to be a group of rejects from other teams, some very unseasoned, talented ball players, but just at a cursory glance, one would never say this is the stuff that championship teams are made of. Tell us what the key was to Don Shula as a coach, why he was able to bring this team into a whole nother level of play, and ultimately to, of course, this season of perfection.
Well, here's the key, and it's a very simple key, but it's a very rare one in NFL history. This rarely happens, what Shula did. And it's simple in that he was able to walk into that locker room and convince that locker room that his way was the right way. And a lot of coaches try that, but it rarely works. It's in today's game, you see it somewhat. You see it with Bill Belichick. You see it a little bit even with Jim Harbaugh in San Francisco. You see it in Green Bay. You don't really see it much elsewhere. It's a very rare thing because especially even then when players respected authority more, you had to prove yourself. And Shula was able to prove himself very, very quickly. And that's the key. And he was able to unite what the team had some talent. There are some Hall of Famers on that team. Paul Warfield, Larry Zonka, Bob Greasy. But as you just correctly stated, this was not a team loaded with great, great Hall of Fame talent. So he was able to get them to buy in, and when you get players to buy in, they perform at their best. He got the best out of everyone, and every coach strives for, but it's a very, very rare thing, and that's what he did. It's really much that simple. He just got them to buy in and got them to give them everything they had.
We're speaking with Mike Freeman and talking about his book, Undefeated, Inside the 1972 Miami Dolphins Perfect Season. That is a season 40 years ago when they were undefeated and untied and ultimately made it all the way back to the Super Bowl with a decisive victory over the Washington Redskins. Ahead of us talking about several of the major players and a couple of the major themes of that season, I want to point out to our listeners that your book may surprise some people for the time that you take talking about matters off of the football field. Specifically, you seem to be very, very much interested in the city of Miami, Florida at this period of time, the late 60s, the early 70s, a very turbulent period for this city. And in a sense, it seems as though the Dolphins played a very important role in this city sort of riding that turbulence. Say a word about Miami, the city, apart from the Dolphins, why you thought this was such an important story to include in this book, which otherwise is about football.
Well, in a lot of ways, the Dolphins and Miami, like a lot of teams, I mean, if you look at the Packers today in Green Bay, they're sort of intertwined. And you cannot tangle the Packers from the city and the state and vice versa. They're very close. And then back then, as Shula started to win, the same thing started to happen. But Shula wanted to do something very different from the city of Miami. The city of Miami was, you know, when you think of the end of racial segregation and Jim Crow laws, most people would think of the Deep South, Mississippi, places like that. Some would think Boston. But the state of Florida was a very hardened, racially segregated place. And the city was very, very racially divided. Jula, and in a lot of ways it reflected the NFL at the time. The NFL at the time was also still very racially divided. Shula took an example from Lombardi and said, I'm going to really fully integrate this locker room. Some of it was just being purely noble, and some of it was just being strategic. Like Lombardi, they wanted to win, but also like Lombardi, they felt sort of this noble pursuit, this they felt they had to do the right thing. And that's what he did. And I write about Miami because Miami was the polar opposite of that locker room. Miami was still racially segregated. The Dolphins were not. The Dolphins were a very close team. The city of Miami was not a very close city. They were in Miami, but they were not a part of Miami, and they were doing things the opposite of what the city was doing. Plus, Miami's just a fascinating city. Even at that time, it was the drug trade was just heating up. It's a very colorful city, and Shula also had to sort of try and protect the Dolphins from Miami. A couple of Dolphins players got heavily involved in drugs, so it wasn't 100% successful, but he tried. So it was. I just found Miami just to be a really fascinating place to write about while this team was also trying to achieve perfection.
Right. Don Shula was able, of course, to bring order to the Dolphins, actually in much the same way that Vince Lombardi had done a couple of decades earlier in Green Bay. And the Dolphins enjoy a couple of very strong seasons, I think 10 victories or so. They ultimately make it to the 1971 Super Bowl, but there they are trounced by the Dallas Cowboys 24-3. You tell us in the book that this is probably one of the only times in Don Shula's history where, especially in an important game, Don Shula was outcoached, in this case by Tom Landry. And this seems to have been a devastating loss on so many different levels. And it's so interesting because, of course, it's the kind of devastation out of which a couple of things can happen. You can spiral further downward or you can rise up. What do you think was most crucial in using this devastating Super Bowl loss to the Cowboys in the most positive, constructive way possible?
Well, that's the biggest question about this team, and the biggest point about this team is that devastating moment Shula considers really kind of his second lowest point. We talked about the first one with the Jets, the loss of the Jets. And I think you put it perfectly. There's that moment where you face, we've all probably had many moments like this, both in our lives and or seen other people where you have a real hard fall, and you can either keep falling or just pick yourself back up. And what Shula did was, instead of having the players forget about the loss, he wanted them to remember it. And the players embraced that. They took mementos from that game and put them around their locker. One player took a picture of the final scoreboard from that game, taped it to his locker, and left it there the whole year. They never forgot that game. They used it as a catalyst. At the beginning of the next season, Shula addresses the team, and he says, remember what happened, never forget, and now let's go win every game. And he didn't mean it in a very general sense. He meant, let's go win every game. And they used that loss to really rally themselves. It was a very impressive thing. I think it's one of the more significant turnarounds in NFL history because you just rarely see a team, well, you've never seen a team, lose like that and then win every game the following year.
Mike Freeman, and his book is called Undefeated, Inside the Perfect Season of the 72 Miami Dolphins, published by IT. I'm Gregory Berg. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Our weather forecast is for cloudy seasonal conditions today with a high of 29 degrees, cloudy tonight as well with a low of 26. Saturday, cloudy with a high all the way up to 39 degrees. And Super Bowl Sunday, we should have cloudy skies, a 30% chance of light rain and snow, and a high of 40. Then our temperatures take a slide. Monday with a 40% chance of light snow, a high of 33. By Tuesday, a high of just 23 degrees. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and